So today, we will discuss the Feynman rules for the matrix element. We started this last time. And just to recall, the scattering amplitude is related to the matrix element by some 2 pi's and a momentum conserving delta. And this matrix element depends both on the initial state and the final state. What we saw last time was, so we were trying to determine what these Feynman rules were by looking at a particular example. The example we were looking at was 2-to-2 scattering. In 5-4 theory. So this means we have 2 initial particles, 2 final particles, their momentum eigenstates, and we wanted to compute the scattering amplitude. LSZ reduction formula relates the scattering amplitude to the correlation function. So the relevant correlation function we need to compute is the 4-point correlation function. And at leading order, there are 3 diagrams that contribute to this. And the notation I used in lecture and in notes were inconsistent, so I'm going to match with the notation I used in the notes, where 1 and 2 are the initial particles, and 3 and 4 are the final particles. Consistent with the notes. So here, as a reminder, time is going upwards. It's not so relevant if we're computing a correlation function, but it doesn't matter if we're computing a matrix element because of this sign difference in how we treat the initial and final particles. Okay, so that's what we were trying to compute. And what we saw last time is that there is a 4 momentum conserving delta. Per connected component. Some of you pointed out there was a mistake in one of the last formulas I wrote last time. I missed some Klein-Gordon operators in the last equations. It's correct in the notes. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to discuss that as well. So what we the key point of that calculation we did at the last time is that there's a momentum conserving delta per connected component. In the scattering amplitude. So that means if we compute the contribution of this diagram to the scattering amplitude, we get 2 momentum conserving deltas instead of the 1 that we'd expect to be there on general principles. So this diagram the contribution to the scattering amplitude from this diagram. That means this notation just means the contribution of this term to the scattering amplitude, which you get by plugging in this term into the LZ reduction formula. So the contribution of this term to the scattering amplitude is proportional to two deltas. So there's a delta of P1 minus P3 and a delta of P2 minus P4, because this has two connected components. And so this is there. This is a contribution to the scattering amplitude, but it's not a particularly interesting one. And why is that?
There's no scattering as such. I mean,
it's just exactly. Thank you. There's no scattering. This is only non-zero if particle 3 is the same as particle 1. There's no change in momentum. We just have particle 1 propagating and particle 2 propagating. So this is there's no scattering here. This is not interesting. And the same is true for this cross diagram. This diagram, we can make an even stronger statement. So this diagram is proportional to P1 plus P2. So P1 and P2 are the momentum of the initial state particles. So they have the same sign. Whereas P1 and P3 were one initial state and one final state particle, so they're the opposite sign. So we can say something even stronger about this term. And assuming that the mass of the particle is positive. What can we say about this term?
Momentum is conserved.
Yes, but in particular, the zeroth component of this term. What is the zeroth component of this term saying?
Energy.
Yes. Can you be more specific, Marco?
There's energy conservation.
Energy conservation. But here, we don't have. So energy conservation for the whole process would be the sum of the final. Setting the sum of the final equal to the sum of the initial. Here we just have sum of the initial for momentum. So what is this? What constraint is this putting on the initial energy?
Zero.
That's right. So this is saying that the initial for momentum and in particular the initial energy has to be zero, which is impossible for massive particles. We have that. So this is always greater than or equal to greater than zero. So this term is just zero. So not only is it not interesting, it's just zero. And this delta structure of the scattering amplitude persists if we have more complicated diagrams that are disconnected. So if we had other diagrams that were disconnected, we'd still have the same delta function structure, and so there'd be no scattering, or at least no scattering of all of the particles. We could have scattering for some of the particles if we were looking at, say, 3-to-3 scattering, maybe two of them scattered and the other one we just had a free particle propagating. So that would be possible if we had more particles, but these terms with disconnected don't correspond to all the particles scattering. So in that sense, they're not so interesting. They also have a key property that means that we don't really have to consider them at the same time as fully connected diagrams. So disconnected diagrams do not interfere with fully connected diagrams. Due to the extra deltas. And to see why that's the case, there's two possible cases. Either the arguments of the extra deltas are zero, or they're non-zero. And so the second case is easier. The arguments of the extra deltas are non-zero. Well, then this term is just zero. The other case, the arguments of the extra deltas are zero. Well, then this term is infinitely larger than a term that just has one delta. Have a delta squared compared to a delta evaluated at zero. So in either case, there's no interference between the disconnected terms and the fully connected terms. Disconnected terms are both uninteresting, and they don't interfere with the fully interesting ones. So the fully connected ones that correspond to all the particles scattering. So for that reason, we usually don't consider them. They're also very easy to distinguish experimentally. You can, if you see a particle where the momentum didn't change, then you know that didn't correspond to scattering. So we will not consider these further. So they're there. They're just not interesting. So instead of computing the full scattering amplitude, we'll just consider the interesting part of it. OK. So if you want to look at 2-to-2 scattering, we have to go to higher order. There's nothing interesting at zeroth order in our coupling. We need to go to the next order, which is order G coupling. And at that order, well, there are many diagrams that contribute to the correlation function at that order. There's only one that's fully connected. So the connected part of this, fully connected, again, this is not equal to the full correlation function itself, just the part we want to consider. It would just be this one diagram where we have 1, 2, x, and 3, 4. Plus higher order terms. Okay, so this is the contribution to the matrix element we want to compute. And let's do that to see how it works. So I can use the Feynman rules we developed last time to write down the analytic expression for this diagram. And there are four propagators, propagator from 1 to x, from 2 to x, from 3 to x, and from 4 to x. We also have one vertex, so we get a minus ig integral d for x. And then I divide by the symmetry factor. What's the symmetry factor of this diagram? I see some fingers, yes. Good. It's 1. There's no way to map this diagram to itself, keeping the external points fixed. Okay. So we want to plug this into the LSED reduction formula. And the LSED reduction formula involves four Klein-Gordon operators acting on this. And, well, that gives us a big simplification because we know that, for example, d squared plus m squared delta 1x is minus I, minus I delta for x1 minus x. So in other words, the Feynman propagator is a Green's function of the Klein-Gordon operator. Now, I've done something very sneaky here, which may not be justified. What did I do? I made a very strong assumption. What mass is this? So this part came from the LSED reduction formula. What mass shows up in that formula?
It comes from the EK.
That's right. Which means it's the physical mass. So let's call it m. This. When we were discussing that the Klein-Gordon operator acting on the Feynman propagator was direct delta, that was all in the interaction picture, all in the free theory. So we assumed a Lagrangian when we wrote this. We assumed that we were working with the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian plus a perturbation. So this holds if m physical squared is m squared. And that's a rather big assumption. We've in no way justified that so far. Nevertheless, let's assume this for now. And we'll come back to justify that later. But if these two masses are the same, or the same plus a small correction that we can neglect in this limit, then we can use the fact that these Klein-Gordon operators acting on the propagators give us deltas. And so we have four Klein-Gordon operators, four propagators, so we'll get four deltas. And in that case, the contribution to the scattering amplitude from this diagram will be, we have the minus ig integral d4x. The LSZ reduction formula tells us to integrate over the location of the fields in the correlation function. We have an exponential of I lambda j pj dot xj. And then we've already taken care of the Klein-Gordon operators and the correlation function. So that will give us then a minus I to the fourth, and then the four deltas. Minus I delta xj minus x. So this is product over j. So I've just plugged this result to the LSZ reduction formula using the fact that the Feynman propagator is a Green's function. Now this is a rather easy integral to evaluate, at least four of them, because we have four deltas. So we can do those integrals. And that will just set xj equal to x. So let's do those four integrals. And the contribution of this diagram is just minus ig. And we still have the integral over x. This is the integral over the location of our internal vertex. And we have an e to the plus from initial state. Yes. I p1 plus p2 minus p3 minus p4. The relative sign is from the sign difference in how we treat initial and final states in the LSZ reduction formula. And then we have, that's all. The minus i's just give us a 1. Oh. OK, and so the last thing we can do is evaluate this integral. And we're taking the Fourier transform of 1. So we just get minus ig 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 p1 plus p2 minus p3 minus p4. This is what we expected on physical grounds. We expect the amplitude should be 0 unless 4 momentum is conserved. And the extra part is the matrix element. So this part here is IM.
Should that be x on that exponent?
Yes. Thank you, Bob. So we see here that IM, for this case, is equal to minus ig. At least of this order. And what have we learned from this? We see that the effect of the Klein-Gordon operators is to remove the propagators for the external lines. So here we have this factors associated with the vertex. We have no factors associated with the external lines. And that's a general feature in one of the rules, one of the Feynman rules for the matrix element.
Dan, please, can you explain again how a graph IM equals to minus IG plus?
So IM is defined to be the whatever's left over after we remove this 2 pi to the fourth and the overall momentum conserving delta.
Oh, okay.
This is the definition. Because we expect this delta should be there on physical grounds.
Okay.
So we don't have to write it all the time. We remove it. And this is just a choice of normalization, 2 pi. The interesting physics is all in here. This should be there for every theory. Okay. So the next rule, I will explain the result and try to give some motivation for why it's true today, but we'll discuss this in more detail tomorrow. So I won't fully explain the justification for this rule. Today, I will discuss it tomorrow. And the next rule is called amputation. And the claim is that the Klein-Gordon operators in the LSZ reduction formula remove external lines with corrections. In other words, for computing the two-point function, in an interacting theory, this is represented not just by a single Feynman diagram. This is the only Feynman diagram that would contribute to the two-point function in a free theory, but it includes corrections. And in Phi-4 theory, the leading correction would be this diagram, but there's also higher order corrections. And these diagrams represent corrections to the propagator. This is the propagator in the interacting theory. This term alone is the propagator in the free theory. We know that the propagator in the free theory is a Klein-Gordon, is a Green's function of the Klein-Gordon operator if we replace the physical mass with the mass that shows up in the Lagrangian. The claim is that the same statement is true, that this object, in a sense, I'll make more precise tomorrow, but if we act with this Klein-Gordon operator with a physical mass on this Green's function of the interacting theory, we just get an I delta. In other words, this operator removes not just the contribution of the external lines, but it also removes the contributions of corrections to the external lines. So that's a brief justification of this statement, and we'll discuss this in more detail tomorrow when we discuss the Chalin-Lemon representation. And that will allow us to make more precise the statements I just made. What amputation means. So what does it mean in practice? We'll focus on that for today. Justify these statements in more detail tomorrow. This means This means if we have a Feynman diagram, let's say a diagram that contributes to 2-to-2 scattering, and there are corrections on one of the external lines, this represents a particle propagating and interacting with itself before it interacts with any of the other external physical particles. So this part represents corrections to the propagator. For an external particle. And amputation means we remove any corrections to the external propagator, so we shouldn't contribute this. So after we amputate this, this just becomes this diagram. So amputation means I chop the diagram after any parts of the diagram where we have a particle just interacting with itself. So if I chop it here and then stretch out this bottom left leg down, I get this diagram. So for another example, I could have another diagram like this, where here we have external particles interacting with each other. And there could also be corrections to the external legs. And if I amputated this diagram, I would again chop these legs off. And it would become this diagram, where the external particles always interact with another external particle before they do any other interactions. Any questions about amputation?
Okay. To make sure that I understood, amputation is basically cutting off all self-interactions, right?
That's right.
Corrections that imply self-interactions.
So, right, self-interactions of external particles. I could add a self-interaction of this vertical particle with itself. That would not be amputated.
Right.
Dan?
Yes.
Yeah, and physically, what does amputation mean?
Physically, it means that the mass. So one piece of information we can get from the propagator is the mass of the particle. We saw that the propagator for the free theory depends on the mass of the particle. That's information contained in the propagator. And what this equation is saying diagrammatically is that, well, the propagator in the interacting theory and the propagator in the free theory are not the same.
Okay.
And those changes can include changes in the mass. So one effect of turning on interactions is it can change the mass in the Lagrangian to something else. So these diagrams are sometimes said to shift the mass of the theory. That's not the only change that these diagrams have, and again, I'll have more to say about that tomorrow. Thanks for the question. Okay. So we've seen that we have overall momentum conservation. We have one delta per connected component. But higher order diagrams have both more vertices, which come with integral d4x's. And they also have more propagators. So in addition to propagators for the external lines, like the example we looked at before, they'll also have propagators for internal lines. And those extra propagators will come with integrals d4k, and they'll also come with an e to the I k dot x, being schematic here. The only x dependence at all comes from these exponentials. So we can simplify a lot, like we did. We can do the x integrals to get rid of these exponentials. That will give us deltas. And then we can do many of those deltas using the k integrals we have, the momentum integrals. So combining these will lead to lots of d4 p's, and also integrals. So let's count those and see how many we have left in the end, instead of doing them every time. Because most of them will cancel, just like they did here. We saw that when the dust settled in this example, we had no, if we're looking at the matrix element, we had no extra momentum integrals or momentum conserving deltas. So let's look at an example to see how this counting works. And our example again will be 2-2 scattering in 5-4 theory. And importantly for this counting, we'll restrict to completely connected diagrams. Those are the interesting ones anyways. Okay. And let's consider a diagram with V vertices and E edges or lines. I'm going to use L for something else, so I'll call these E. So the number of momentum integrals we will have will be, so we get one for every internal line. The Klein-Gordon operators will kill the propagators to the external lines, like we just saw. So the number of momentum integrals we start with is E minus 4. This is the number of internal lines. Every vertex is going to come with a integral d4x, which we can use after we do the integral then of the exponentials, we'll get a delta. So this essentially contributes, every vertex will contribute a delta, which we can use to eliminate one of our momentum integrals. So we're left, we remove the integrals if we're computing the scattering amplitude, but if we're computing the matrix element, we should remove V minus 1. So here this 1 is because we have a 1 delta pulled out of IM. And so the total number of momentum integrals we have is E minus V minus 3. Okay. And this result is particular to this theory, or this process. If we change the number of external particles, we change this number. We can write a general relation between the number of momentum integrals we have and the number of loops using Euler's formula. So Euler's formula says that the Euler characteristic, which is defined to be E minus V plus L. L is the number of loops. Is a constant. If we fix the, this is a topological constant. So this only depends on the topology of our diagrams. So here L is the number of independent loops. And we can compute this. There's a theorem by Euler that says that this is a constant for all of these 2-to-2 connected diagrams. And so we can compute this for any one diagram. For this diagram, we have that chi is equal to the number of edges minus the number of vertices. Did I make a sign mistake? Possibly. V minus E plus L. Yes. So minus 4 plus 1 plus the number of loops. This diagram has no loops. So this is minus 3. So this says that for all of these diagrams, we have that the number of loops is equal to E minus V minus 3, which is exactly the same thing we had before, E minus V minus 3. The minus 3 will depend on the process we're considering, but it's generally true that the number of momentum integrals is equal to the number of loops. And there are no deltas left, except for the overall momentum conserving delta.
If L is E minus V minus 3, then what does that 0 stand for?
This is known as the Euler characteristic.
V is equal to 1.
V is equal to 1. For this diagram, yeah. I have four lines. E represents the number of lines, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. There's one vertex.
And 0?
Zero loops. So a diagram with a loop would be a diagram like this. This diagram has L equals 1. Or I could draw a diagram like this. It would have L equals 2.
So basically, you are saying that L is equal to 0, and the Euler characteristic is equal to minus 3, and you are saying that the Euler characteristic is still E minus V minus 3.
No, for this class of diagrams, it's L in general. L is equal to E minus V minus the plus the Euler characteristic. And for the class of diagrams we're looking at, Euler characteristic is minus 3. We can let's compute the Euler characteristic for one of the other ones to make sure this works. So here we have E equals 6 and V equals 2. So the Euler characteristic is minus 6 plus 1 plus 2. It's minus 3. For this one, we have L equals 2. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 lines. And 1, 2, 3 vertices. So chi is equal to minus 8 plus 2 plus 3 equals minus 3. This would change if we changed the number of external particles, but this result would not. Yes,
About the relation there, is that minus 1 because of the momentum conservation dimension?
Yes, this one is because we want there to be one delta left at the end.
So we have that momentum conservation, and we can write one momentum as a function of other. So yeah, this minus 1.
That's where the minus 1, that's exactly right. Yes. Okay.
So we connected like a topological invariant chi to a type of scattering, right? If we change the type of scattering, then our chi changes, right?
That's right. Chi will change. But this relation between the number of momentum integrals and the number of loop integrals will also change. If we had more particles in our initial or final state, we'd change this 4. We'd start with a different number of momentum integrals. And that change in the number of momentum integrals would exactly offset the change in chi. So if we added more initial or final particles, that would decrease the number of momentum integrals and also chi by the same amount. Okay, this is a good place to take a break. I'll resume in 5 minutes. Yes, so not prepared to go through the proof, but if you look at what you need to do to add an extra vertex to a diagram without adding external points, you have to connect those extra lines to something. So every time you're adding an extra vertex, you're also adding 4 ends of lines or 2 lines. And you also have to add a loop. So you're adding basically one vertex, two edges, two E. You're increasing E by 2, L by 1, and D by 1.
To maybe understand like mathematically better, so is it like cell structure for all the like graphs, like for two scattering cell structures are like same?
What this is saying is that the number of momentum integrals we have just depends on, well, we did the counting. It depends on the number. We can either write it in terms of the number of lines and the number of vertices, or by or this formula in terms of the number of loops. The number of loops is easier.
And then minus 1 with V, that's because of like general conservation of momentum?
That's exactly right, yes. Thanks, sir.
Okay.
Okay.
And generally, we are now deriving the rules for IM, right?
Like correct. That's right, yes. Yes, so we basically have all the ingredients we need for the Feynman rules for IM, so let's write them all down and put together what we've done. Okay. So first of all, I am, or at least the interesting part of, is equal to the sum of all completely connected amputated diagrams. So this is a different set of diagrams than we were considering for the endpoint function. The endpoint function, we looked at the sum of all diagrams with no vacuum subdiagrams. That's a weaker constraint than we have here. Here we have a much stronger constraint, and there'll in general be far fewer diagrams that contribute to the matrix element than contribute to the correlation functions. Okay. So that's diagrams to consider. And then again, we can write down rules for associating analytic expressions with those diagrams. Our first rule is that internal lines which I will denote by a line with a momentum label, indicating that we're computing something in momentum space. And I indicated the direction that the momentum is flowing by putting an arrow next to the line. Didn't put it on the line. We already used arrows on the line to indicate the flow of charge. And this line is just associated with the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator, or I over P squared minus M squared plus I epsilon. External lines. Just get a factor of one. Contribution on the external line is removed by the Klein-Gordon operator in the LSZ reduction formula. So we don't need to do anything for those. Our next rule, in the same order, okay, is for the vertex. So we don't need to label our vertices if we're in momentum space. Points are associated with points in space-time. We're working in momentum space, so I'm not putting a label on the vertex itself. And this just gives us a factor of minus ig. We've already taken care of the other part of the vertex, the integral over space-time. So just a factor of minus I times the coupling. And this depends on the theory. Just like for the correlation functions. That was the one rule that depended on the theory. Rule four is we should impose by hand momentum conservation at each vertex. When we're doing as many momentum integrals as possible, we get all these integrals over space-time from the vertices. We also, for every vertex, will have some exponentials associated with that vertex. And doing that integral will give us a delta that imposes momentum conservation at that vertex. we can then get rid of that delta using some of the spare case. So we need to make sure that we're still conserving momentum at each vertex, and we'll do that by hand. So here there's no deltas. Now, it might not be possible to uniquely determine all of the momenta, so we might have some undetermined momentum, and those will be associated with the leftover momentum integrals. We know we have, in the earlier discussion, we have one momentum integral per loop. And that's an integral d4k, not d3k. The propagators have four momentum integrals in them when we write them in terms of the Feynman contour or with the I epsilon prescription. So here there's one per loop. And finally, we need to divide by the symmetry factor. So this works the same as the correlation functions. OK, so let's look at an example to make sure this makes sense. For our example, let's consider a one-loop diagram. So we're computing the contribution of this diagram to the matrix element. The matrix element depends on the initial and final momenta. So the first thing I do is I label the external momenta. So I'll say the initial momenta are p1 and p2. And our final momenta are p3. P4. Note that I'm not applying these in the order I've written them down. This is the order we derive them. But when we're applying them in practice, we want to do rule 4 first. So what we need to do is impose momentum conservation. So we don't have any labels on either of these two lines. And I know, based on rule 5, that there should be one momentum I'm integrating over. And I can choose either of the lines in either direction for that momentum to go. So let's just say that I choose that the top line has momentum k, and it's going that way. The choice, the amplitude I'll write down, won't depend on that choice. I could have chosen k going the other way. Could have put k on the bottom line. No, doesn't matter. That should be the only choice. I only have one loop, so there should be just one free momentum. And then I can use this vertex to figure out what the momentum here has to be. And I can choose which way it's going. Let's say I choose it's going that way. The momentum conservate, and let's call this, let's give it a name, call it K1. All right, let's call it Q. So momentum conservation tells us that at this vertex, we have P1 going in. So we have P1 should be equal to P3 plus K plus Q. Or in other words, Q is equal to P1 minus P3 minus K. So I've labeled all the momenta, and it should work for the other vertex as well. If I look at this vertex, this is telling us going in, we have P2 plus K plus Q. And that should be equal to P4. The K's cancel. K's cancel. And if I rearrange this equation, this says that P1 plus P2 is equal to P3 plus P4, which is overall momentum conservation. So this is momentum's conserved here. As long as overall momentum is conserved. Then to write down the expression for this diagram, I can go back to rule number one. So I have two internal lines. For the top line, I get an I over K squared minus M squared plus I epsilon. For the bottom line, I have an I over P1 minus P3 minus K squared minus M squared psi epsilon. And important to keep in mind that these are four vectors here. So this is the square of this four vector. That will play an important role when we learn how to evaluate these integrals in future courses. Okay, so that's rule one. Rule two, external lines, I don't have to do anything. Again, this will change in QFT1. Rule three, vertex, so I get a minus IG. Then rule five, integrate over my undetermined momentum, so D4K for 2π⁴. And finally,
should it be like minus ig squared?
Yes, thank you. Minus ig squared, two vertices. Thank you. And finally, divide by the symmetry factor. What's the symmetry factor of this diagram? Yes, I see some fingers going up. So this is the symmetry factor of two. The symmetry factors don't depend on if we write them in position space or momentum space, so they'll always be the same. This diagram, if we labeled the points instead of the lines, would have two indistinguishable lines in the middle. So I could swap those two. That's just where the symmetry factor comes. So that's the expression for this diagram.
I still don't get it why it's two. Because like for counting the symmetry factor, you can also switch the internal points and switch the ends of the internal line.
No, because I can tell which one is of the internal points is which by making a statement that only refers to the external points. I can say this internal vertex is the one next to point one and three. So this expression should have a propagator from one to one of the external points and three to the other one. So if I exchange, another way of saying it is if I exchange these two internal points, that would not map this way of drawing the diagram on the blackboard to the same way of drawing to it. It'd map it to a different way of representing this class of diagrams.
Why would like a switch in the internal points not map it to itself?
So if I swapped the internal points, it would become something like this. So it's not the same way of drawing the diagram on the board. Yes.
So do the directions, okay, so yeah, the directions of the arrows don't matter when you're computing the symmetry factor.
No. The direction of the momentum, arrows don't matter. The charge arrows do matter. And that's why I'm careful to always draw my momentum arrows off the lines, because they mean different things. Okay. So we'll learn, and in future courses, we'll learn technically how we can compute these terms, but I want to focus on the concepts first. So in order to relate these expressions to any physical observables, we need to renormalize our theory. So I want to briefly start discussing renormalization today. We'll continue this discussion next time. One of the key ideas that explains why renormalization works is this idea of separation of scales. I alluded to earlier in the course. And separation of scales means we can predict how an apple falls without knowing cosmology or atomic physics. And the fact that separation of scales works is why we can explain the world. It's, if we had to understand cosmology and atomic physics in order to predict how an apple falls, Newton would have had a much harder time. So that, at a physical level, that's what separation of scales means. Let's think about what that tells us mathematically about our theories. So our goal be to predict something near a physical scale mu. So that means we want to make prediction for some observable. We want to know what some observable we can predict depend on the momentum at which we measure it, the magnitude of the momentum, for p approximately equal to mu. This is perhaps a weaker condition than you're used to. Classical physics, we often don't have to think about the scale at which we're measuring things. That's very implicit. If we're using Newtonian physics to predict how an apple falls, well, we expect that has some very small corrections due to general relativity, for example. But those would be unimportant because we're measuring the position of an apple just at a scale of centimeters or something. But in quantum field theory, these effects can be important. The explicit expressions for the observables will depend. We'll need to think carefully about what scale we're trying to measure our theory on. And we saw this a bit when we were discussing the Casimir effect. Casimir effect, we had three very different scales in energy. We had the scale we were trying to measure things at. That was the distance between the plates. That was some macroscopic scale. But we had to introduce two other scales into our problem. And to introduce a UV cutoff to deal with the UV divergences of the theory. And we had to introduce an IR cutoff. We put our theory in a box. And we made a prediction, assuming these scales were all well separated. So we assumed that lambda was much larger than mu, and mu was much larger than 1 over L. And our predictions would work in a range of energies. We changed mu a little bit, that would our formulas would still work. The way we did this, the way we did our calculation, was we introduced some auxiliary quantities. We introduced some unobservable quantities. That we use to calculate things. I say that's Q. And that depended on many parameters. It depended on lambda, depended on mu, depended on 1 over L, depended on the scale at which we're measuring, could depend on the coupling constants of the theory. So here P is the scale at which we're measuring. And C would be some coupling constants. And you can think about this. This is something like the ground state energy. When we were computing the Casimir effect, we computed the ground state energy. That wasn't observable. We had to regulate our theory so we can make this finite. And in the end, what we were computing was the force, which was some observable. And that depended on not all these parameters. Shouldn't depend on lambda, shouldn't depend on L. And so we computed O, which depended on our observable, which depended on P and our coupling constants. And at a more technical level, this is what we mean by separation of scales, is when we compute the things we observe, it shouldn't depend on scales that are very far separated from it. I'd like to give another more concrete example of how this works, where we can compute everything. Before we go into quantum field theory, where the calculations we'll do in principle are the same as we're going to do in this example, the technical details are more involved. So this example, I think, is very useful to have in mind, and we'll study it in much more detail tomorrow. I hope it's a useful example throughout the year to come back to, because you can see all the details in a simple context. So again, I encourage you to do the quiz before tomorrow's class. And the example we're going to look at that illustrates these ideas is a local potential in 1D non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So what I mean by local potential is a potential that's identically zero outside of some finite range. So V of x identically zero for the absolute value of x greater than a. And it just has something non-trivial in a small range. And the problem we'll be interested in studying is scattering from this potential in the limit P is much greater than 1 over A. So we're having a low momentum or low energy probe of this potential. What do we expect? We expect we should not be able to resolve the fine details of this potential from a low energy probe. And that observation is going to be extremely powerful. That will put some very strong constraints on the theory. Now, the potential is identically zero in the region outside of this small region around the origin. So we expect that the wave function, we're looking at scattering. We should be able to look at scattering by saying that there's some incoming wave function, which is a e to the I p dot x. Some transmitted part of the wave function is, I call it C, and some reflected part of the wave function, which is B to the minus IP dot X. So the transmission coefficient is something we can observe with a low energy probe. And transmission coefficient is just C over A. So this is something we should be able to measure just by measuring the wave function far away. We can extract these coefficients. But, and that's something we should be able to compute approximately as well. We should be able to use perturbation theory to do that. So we should be able to do perturbation theory that involves the low energy modes to get the transmission coefficient. We also know that while the wave function we expect is very slowly varying in this region, it may be rapidly varying in between minus A and A. So describing scattering in this potential with only low energy modes is going to be difficult or impossible. Because there's high energy modes in the exact solution. There's a coupling between our low energy modes and our high energy modes, which we'll have to take into account if we want to make a prediction for the transmission coefficient at low energies. So this is something we can observe at low energies. But it's not something, at least, that we can calculate easily by only making references to low energy modes. So this is something we can measure at low energies, but we cannot, at least easily, calculate T without taking into account high energy modes. And this is very similar to what occurs in quantum field theory. If we look at example we have up here, this is a scattering amplitude we might be interested in computing at low energies. If we want to compute it using perturbation theory, this involves an integral that involves all momenta. So this mixing of the low energy modes with the high energy modes. We know our final answer should be able to express without reference to what's going on at high energies due to separation of scales. But to compute it, we have to take into account all scales, at least if we're computing it this way. And so this toy example, it's a toy example, but it has many of the key features that we'll see in quantum field theory. This mixing of the low energy modes and the high energy modes. It also, I'll have to say more about this tomorrow, but it also runs us, makes us confront the idea of what do we mean by the coupling constants. So there's a naive way we can define coupling constants, which I'll have to say more about tomorrow. It's a natural way you would define coupling constants if you're just thinking about this potential, using the tools you've used to study scattering and one-dimensional potentials. But that runs into conflict with the fact that we want to express everything in terms of low energy observables. So there's different notions of how we can define our coupling constant that we have to think about in this problem, which again is exactly analogous to what we'll do in quantum field theory. So we'll go through this. I'll have a few more things to say about this in general at tomorrow's lecture, but then we'll go through all the details of this in tomorrow's tutorial, which I think is very illustrative for the concepts we'll encounter in a technically more complicated setting later in the year. Any questions about that? Yes.
Where exactly did we lose the fact that D is much greater than 1 by N?
This is the regime we're interested in. If we're interested in this regime, then we should be able to express T as a function just of a P and some coupling that tells us how strong this potential is. So in particular, it shouldn't depend on the details of this potential. If it did, we'd be able to, with one experiment, or with low energy experiments, detect what's going on at very high energies. Or in other words, if that was violated, we'd have to know about atomic physics to describe how an apple fell. Go, Jen.
By high energy modes, are you talking about the high frequency modes of the Fourier decomposition of the wave function?
Exactly, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Fer. Okay. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.